Judge, the next matter is number 25-2109, Tracy Greigel versus Health Equity Incorporated. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please come to the podium and introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning. May it please the court. Joseph Solomon for the plaintiff appellant, Tracy Greigel. May I ask for 1 minute of rebuttal time, please?
You may.
Thank you. We're asking this court today to reverse and remand the district court's order granting the defendant's motion to dismiss the claims of discrimination and retaliation under the Massachusetts Chapter 151B and the federal Title VII. I will first discuss the discrimination claims under both federal and state law and why the allegations were sufficient to withstand the motion to dismiss under this court's plausibility standard. Plausibility, as this court knows, does not require showing evidence under the sufficiency of the evidence standard under summary judgment, but simply allegations that put the defendant on notice and raise a right to relief that makes a right to relief plausible on the face of the complaint and show that discovery will help supplement that right to relief. Now, that's under the Ocasio-Hernandez case that I rely a lot on my brief. And before I get to that, I want to sort of highlight the fact pattern here, because although I acknowledge that this complaint had some fat on the bone and maybe you had to get through that and separate the wheat from the chaff a little bit, I believe the fact pattern here is a very typical fact pattern for a discrimination complaint that really is, I believe if the district court order is upheld, it's going to create a heightened burden for a discrimination complaint that's not intended by the district court. Because what the fact pattern here shows is that there is the plaintiff, a woman, who worked for in a male-dominant field. She was the only woman working for an all-male IT department for doing security work. That's in the complaint. She received extra scrutiny at her work. This is also in the complaint and a well-pleaded fact, and I'll point to that if necessary. She was given a derogatory term called a token woman in a meeting with a supervisor, project manager, that her director, her decision maker, attended. She performed better than the men there. She identified security flaws that the men didn't. Again, that's also in the complaint. And then immediately after that, she was excluded from meetings by her decision maker, by Mr. Easterly. Okay. She was given a lower bonus by Mr. Easterly. She was put on a PIP by Mr. Easterly. Okay. And then she was terminated. Those are all in the complaint and well pleaded. Those aren't conclusionary allegations. Those are factual allegations. Okay. Now, under this court's decision on Ocasio-Hernandez, those need to be considered on the cumulative effects on those of that, and all those need to be considered in toto, as we say, not piecemeal and not on a one-to-one sort of one-to-one match under the prima facie case. I understand a prima facie case can be used as backdrop, but it doesn't need to meet the prima facie case. Now, that is more than sufficient. It's not saying it's a slam dunk case, doesn't present some kind of overwhelming case, but that is a typical case for a discrimination case. Someone is a sole, say a black person works in an all white department, a Muslim works in an all Christian, Judeo-Christian department, and they receive extra scrutiny, there's a derogatory term used, they perform better, and then they receive a PIP by the decision maker, and they're fired. That creates a plausible claim of discrimination that warrants further discovery at the pleading stage.
What do you do with the fact that I think the clearest comments came from a coworker rather than a decision maker?
Okay. Thank you, Judge Dunlap. Two responses to that. One, not clearly a coworker, a project manager. This is somebody who was in management. My client was a subordinate. So
Was it pled in the complaint, just so I adequately understand? Was it pled in the complaint that she was his subordinate? I thought he was a manager, but not necessarily in her department.
I would agree with you. It's not clear in the complaint that it's her supervisor, but it's still a manager who she's meeting with on a project. So I don't think it's fair to say a coordinate, like an equal level person. But I think the law is sort of clear. The law says it's somebody who's just an equal person who has no management control over you. That's something. But here it's a project manager she's meeting with. But more to the point, the decision maker, Mr. Easterly, is there and the meeting of a project she's on.
And then that, do you impute, is there a case law on that point that you impute if somebody else is present, doesn't say something? What's the status of law?
What I would argue, I would look at the Crozier Hernandez decision at page 15. This decision looks at all of the comments, all the allegations, including the comments by the decision maker's clerical staff. And it's very clear they do that, which were rejected by the district court. Because if you look at their, I believe it's their Rodriguez-Reyes case, they say you can't always tell motive intent directly from the decision maker. But you can infer that from the circumstantial evidence. Because, of course, at the pleading stage, you're not always going to have direct evidence of the decision maker's comments or statements or actions regarding the protected class. But you can infer that from the circumstantial evidence. That's what Rodriguez-Reyes says. So here we have the decision maker attending a meeting with Mr. I think it's his name is Mr. Sahu, who says, calls him a token woman. Then after this, and Mr. Easterly is at that meeting, directly after that, gives extra scrutiny to Ms. Greigel, then discounts her, gives her extra scrutiny when she performs better than the men, docks her bonus, and puts on her PIP.
What are the best pieces of evidence to tie it to the protected class, as opposed to, you know, you could argue that somebody is upset that a person, regardless of man or woman, identified some shortcoming in their work previously, and so they start slighting that person. What's your best response to that read of the situation?
Well, the best evidence would be, I think, again, I don't want to isolate evidence, but mm-hmm. The best evidence would be the comment, the token woman comment, and then combined with the fact that she is, she's being given heightened scrutiny compared to the men.
Is there comparator evidence?
Well, this is what the comparator evidence is, because she's working with a department with only men. So in paragraph 46, we allege Mr. Easterly put her on her first PIP after she found security problems that male coworkers had not found. And that's a very discreet, particular allegation about what she did compared to men. In paragraph 50 to 55, we allege that she contradicted Mr. Easterly on advice for security, and then she was silenced. This is between paragraph 50 to 55.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You're right, of course, that we have to look at all the allegations in total, but as the district court pointed out, there is this issue which you've been trying to address of there aren't any discriminatory comments really that have been attributed to the decision makers here. And the comment that you just spent a few minutes focusing on by that project manager, I believe happens 9, 10, 8, many months before she's terminated. And so given the amount of time that has passed, that it's not a comment by the decision maker, what else do you have that really shows here that at the time that she was terminated and the reason for her termination was obviously something entirely different, that was pretextual, that you've alleged a plausible claim that the real reason that she was fired by Mr. Easterly was because of her sex?
Well, I'd have two responses to that. First, Judge Rickleman, this is not a retaliation case where the issue of temporal proximity, at least under the case law, I would say, I understand temporal proximity when there's protected conduct, at least in the case law, it says, well, how close in that to the adverse action comes out. Here, we have a statement showing clear gender animus, or at least some gender comment.
I understand, but it's not by her supervisor, and it's many months before she's terminated for a different reason.
But it's still there. It's akin to a comment of any type of racial or gender comment or any type of prejudicial comment. I don't know if people stop believing in those things and stop just because it was that is, that comment was, is still there. And then there's other allegations of similar actions later that, for instance, in paragraph 46, when we say Mr. Easterly put her on her first PIP because when she found security problems that male coworkers had not found. That was in paragraph 46. So, and then later, he gave her a lower bonus. And he was disregarding her work in paragraph 72. So there's lots of later allegations, not directly tied to gender, but that, that on the pleading stage, I believe that first allegation is only 9 months earlier. It's not like several years earlier. At the pleading stage, where the facts are construed in light most favorable to the plaintiff, and we're not asking about probability, we're asking for plausibility. To the idea that that feeling simply goes away, it dissipates. I don't know. I think that's an issue of really the persuasiveness of the evidence, rather than whether it's admissible or not.
Can I turn you to the retaliation aspect of your argument, because I don't want to lose that before you're done. What can you address, I guess, what I might characterize as potential floodgate concerns on a retaliation claim based on kind of unauthorized transfer of electronic documents from the company to personal records? Does that open the door, do you think, where an employer might not have any knowledge of why the emails had been improperly removed from the company's possession, and then the company acts in accordance with their policy that prohibits that, and then subsequently finds out that, in fact, the person transferred it in the self-help effort relating to a future claim that had not yet been made? Like, is that enough to sustain a retaliation claim, or does it need to be a little more apparent to an employer that the conduct was actually protected in some way under Title VII?
Well, I would say to that is, one, for Title VII, that might be an issue. Under Chapter 151B, since this case is sitting in diversity, we have to follow the SJC's ruling. So for Title VII, you know, this, we're breaking new ground here, frankly, because it's not an issue been decided under Title VII.
Right.
Because this
but is... But it's the totalities of the circumstances test, really, as
for
I
Chapter
read.
Chapter 151B.
Chapter,
right.
And they listed out some helpful factors to think about.
Right.
But they didn't really address this. I guess that's a threshold question. Is it something that we need to certify to the state court? Like, what, we don't seem to have much guidance on that particular point, and I'm just wondering what's sufficient to survive a 12b6 on that point.
Right, and I would just argue that we need to, you can only really go by the complaint, and I was careful in drafting this complaint to say she only forwarded documents that she already had, emails at the PIP, I think, and policies. She already had gone to HR to complain about being called a toke woman, so she could already raise the issue of discrimination. So these were clearly related to her being discriminated against, or she believed, she had a reasonable belief she was discriminated against. She knew thought she was going to be terminated because they told her, accept this PIP or face resignation.
Okay, so your position is that there is sufficient indicia before she transferred the documents that should have put the company on notice that it was potentially her decision to transfer those documents was potentially related to her employment discrimination claim.
An HR complaint. They don't have to know, just like you don't have to know about the complaint I gave in my brief was USERRA. You don't have to know about the USERRA law to know that somebody is going to military leave. They don't have to know about this is protected under the law to know that it's related to a discrimination issue, HR complaint. They knew that she was forwarding this. They knew she complained about discrimination. And therefore, under the Verdrager decision, it is protected at least under a 12b6 standard.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellee please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jennifer Markowski on behalf of Health Equity, the appellee. And here with me is Alexandra Held, also on behalf of Health Equity, the appellee. The district court's judgment should be affirmed because the amended complaint does not plausibly state facts sufficient to suggest that Ms. Grigel was terminated because of either her sex, because she engaged in protected activity, or because there was some public policy violation, which was the last count that has been asserted against Health Equity. I want to spend just a moment on the plausibility standard. I know you're all familiar with it, but it really comes into play with regard to the discrimination claim that is at the heart, at least, of one of the arguments in appellant's brief. And that is that in order for an allegation to be plausible, you have to be able to draw a reasonable inference from the allegations themselves. It isn't just something that's conceivable or possible. There has to be a connection. And I know there are some questions about gender and where does gender come into play in this particular case? Where is the connection between the allegations and the fact that decisions or actions were made based upon her gender? And I'll spend a little bit of time talking about our view of that. I also would like to highlight that the conclusory type allegations are allegations that should not be relied upon, an allegation that somebody engaged in discrimination or did it because of somebody's gender. There have to be specific facts, and I think there are questions that appropriately highlighted where is the evidence of a connection to gender, and particularly with regard to Mr. Easterly, who appellant alleges was really the decision maker here, or at least part of the decision making process. A couple of questions I want to clarify in terms of Mr. Sahu. While he may have had the title of manager, there's no allegations in the complaint that he actually had the responsibilities of a manager. And in order to be considered a manager under the law for purposes of 151B, there have to be some specifics. It's not just in title alone. It is somebody who actually has the authority, or at least the impression of authority, over the plaintiff. We don't have that in this case, and he is therefore a co-worker to Ms. Grigel for purposes of this particular case.
What do you do with the presence of Mr. Easterly with the token woman comment?
Yes. So the allegation, as you know, relates to a conversation, a phone conference or a Teams call, something of that nature, where Mr. Easterly was present and Mr. Sahu allegedly made this comment. To what appellant has to do in this case is show that there was some connection between Mr. Easterly's mindset, that he harbored gender animus, and understanding that we have to draw inferences in the favor of Grigel on these issues, there is simply nothing that suggests that Easterly harbored animus towards gender. You can infer that he was on the call. I suppose you could infer that he heard the comment, but he might not have even heard the comment. But we certainly don't know why he didn't say anything, and it doesn't necessarily follow from that, nor would it be a reasonable inference to conclude that because he didn't say it at that moment, that that is a basis to conclude or infer that it was because he harbored gender animus.
What about the allegation that he placed her on a PIP shortly thereafter, and the way the allegation is framed is that she was placed on the PIP because she found problems with her audit that male colleagues hadn't found in the past.
Yeah, so just a little bit on the timeline too. So she was interviewed in May, hired in May of 2023. Just to be clear for the record, this came up in the appellant's brief. In paragraph 14 of the complaint, it is alleged that Mr. Easterly was involved in her hiring. And I want to highlight this because I think it's important. She actually alleges that after he interviewed her, he said that out of the hundreds of applicants, she was the first one to impress him. So he interviews with her she's hired, and shortly thereafter, she turns in this audit. It's alleged that it was in May or June of 2023. And thereafter, she says that after receiving the audit, he was unhappy with her, and he started to treat her negatively, and cites to a variety of different things. That, too, is another occurrence where there are any number of different inferences that could be drawn that have nothing to do with her gender. But the fact is she is a female and she will always be a female, and that's just a fact of the case. But that doesn't mean that that decision, the reasonable inference is that it was because of her gender. And in this instance, you could imagine that perhaps there were issues with the audit. He didn't like to be challenged. He disagreed with her. Again, taking inferences in her favor and not suggesting that that was the case, but it does not equate to or even reasonably suggest that that was, that he harbored animus based upon her gender. And my read of the allegations in the case that in terms of Mr. Easterly, those are the two highlighted facts that Grigel points to say, this is where my gender came into play because I challenged him. I presented an audit. There were some questions about the similarly situated, the comparator evidence. I would say based on the allegations in this complaint, there has not been a claim raised that other individuals similarly situated were treated more favorably than Ms. Grigel was. The allegation is simply that about how she was treated. There's no allegation that somebody else did the same kind of a report or a similar kind of report or challenged Mr. Easterly in some way, and that male counterpart did not get criticized. There's no allegation that other men on the conference calls were not redirected in their questioning or told, you know, that's enough, stop talking. There's no allegation suggesting that he was treating Ms. Grigel differently than her male counterparts. And that's important because without some connection to gender, it is simply allegations about a business relationship with a manager expressing his management style, expressing his views, expressing opinions. And there's no suggestion, again, other than the fact that she's a woman, that it would have anything to do with her gender. So I do want to emphasize, come back to the point of he was involved in her interview and hiring process, and he did have very positive things to say about her, and that's specifically alleged in detail in the complaint, what he said, and he knew at that time that she was a woman. So I think that is a compelling piece of information that cannot be overlooked, and I agree entirely that we do need to look at these complaints, all of the factual allegations in the complaints in their entirety, but it also requires looking at them individually to see if there is a connection that can create the inference that is required to overcome the motion to dismiss. So I think that is a very important fact that should not be overlooked.
Counsel, what about the retaliation claim and the self-help aspect of the claim in particular in light of Massachusetts law?
Yes. Well, I would really like to spend a little bit of time talking about Verdrager because I do believe we have very much a difference of opinion on what Verdrager actually even stands for. So Verdrager, as you know, is a case that involved self-help discovery. And just backing up a little bit because there are stark differences between Grigel's case and the Verdrager case. First of all, in the Verdrager case, the employee had actually filed an internal complaint of discrimination, gender discrimination, long time before this self-help discovery she had taken the self-help discovery. And then in our case, we don't have allegations in this complaint of her filing an internal gender discrimination complaint. The retaliation claim is focused on simply the self-help discovery. And as you saw from our briefs, our position is they didn't know nor have any reason to know or think that she was pursuing a gender discrimination claim.
What about opposing counsel's discussion during oral argument that she had made a complaint to HR?
We have briefed this, and I was going through the complaint as oral argument was going on to see, you know, where that is in the amended complaint. I don't believe there's something in here from which it can be inferred that she put the company on notice that she had a claim. In fact, the allegations actually say that she engaged in this alleged self-help discovery because for a future potential claim, not that she had actually asserted a claim. So we have read and always read, and I again, didn't have enough time. It was a surprise to me to hear that, but I don't see any allegations in the amended complaint that she made a claim of gender discrimination. And our view has been it's been focused on this self-help discovery. And that standing alone, under Verdrager even, is not sufficient to establish a protected activity that would be fall under the guise of 151B. So again, coming back to the case in Verdrager, she had filed a complaint. It was clear the employer knew. She had also engaged an attorney who advised her, you should look and see what kind of information you can find to support your case. And she did that. She searched and found confidential emails and provided, made copies of those, provided them to her lawyer. And after subsequently, the employer found out what she had done and terminated her and said, you violated a policy. And it was clear she had violated a policy. So here's another place where we diverge from Verdrager and the facts of this case. In Verdrager, again, the employer was on notice that what she was doing was to in furtherance of her claim. In this case, when there's no allegation that when presented with the reason for her termination, she said, wait, self-help discovery, let me explain what's going on here. I feel I've been discriminated against, and that's why I did this. So that's difference number two.
In Verdrager, I don't remember right now did the plaintiff do that? Did the plaintiff say at the time of the firing, I did this because I wanted the documents for the claim?
It was clear from the doc, some of them were voice recordings, some of them were memos from a prior case, an internal discrimination case. So on the face of those documents, it was clear that she was pulling evidence of discrimination. Whereas in this case, when what is being alleged is that the plaintiff sent herself two PIPs. And the policy at issue here is that she was emailing from a health equity account things to a personal account. So that's the policy violation. So she alleges she sent two PIPs, which of course in Massachusetts, you can request your personnel file and you would get your PIP. In Verdrager, there was the concern that those documents would be destroyed. And that's part of the discussion in that case about she was doing this out of fear that the documents were going to be destroyed and they were relevant to the case. So in this case, and again,
the various cases talk some about availability of these documents through discovery, and they don't exactly talk about it in this way, but it strikes me that would there need to be some threat of destruction of evidence to justify taking these self-help efforts? Or can they just take these self-help efforts without any indication that the employer may destroy the documents?
Yes, no, I'm not suggesting in any way that there has to be a threat of potential destruction. I'm just comparing the information that was being taken in Verdrager versus the information that is alleged to have been taken here to distinguish between the two cases. And ultimately, other than the PIPs, you can't tell from the allegations in the complaint how any of this would have even helped a potential discrimination claim. The emails are described as important emails, but don't say what the content of them was or what they related to, just important. And I would note that this is an amended complaint, and the judge did also allow an opportunity to amend the complaint with her decision in mind to add additional details to this. There was no further amended complaint. It doesn't have to be something that is likely to be destroyed. It's just the dichotomy of these two cases, and you have to
the other documents were training certificates.
Correct.
Okay. Relating only to her.
That's the allegation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But layering onto it, the Verdrager case it wasn't an issue that was even decided in Verdrager because they said, we don't need to get to this. We don't even need to determine whether or not she did describe in self-help. Whether she did engage in self-help discovery. We just need to, we want to raise this issue to say it is possible for an employee to engage in self-help discovery. And we think it's an important issue and we're going to explain it. But they made very clear, it is a very narrow exception.
But is it a fact-based question that needs to be fleshed out following discovery, I suppose, is the question that we face.
If it were a situation where she had, I'm sorry, may I continue? Where she had actually engaged in reporting a complaint, put the employer on notice, then we would be in a very different situation and it would be a factual issue. Is this another extension of her self-help discovery? And did the employer use this as pretext to terminate her to say, you violated that policy, so we're going to terminate you? And then you get into a factual dispute of whether or not there's evidence of pretext. But here you never get there because there was no engagement in protected activity in the first instance of opposing the discriminatory practice. You just jump right to self-help discovery. And if I may, just one last point, that this would open the floodgates for employees who were terminated for sending something to themselves to just say, well, and in violation of a policy, say, I did that because I think I might have a claim against you. And so, therefore, that's why I was doing this, without ever putting the employer notice that they were doing that. And at the heart of retaliation,
it seems to me that it might be relevant what the things were that she was forwarding, what they related to. Was the company aware of what things she had forwarded when it terminated her?
Yes, okay. They were aware of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, would counsel for the appellant please reintroduce himself on the record?
Thank you, Your Honors. Joseph Solman for the plaintiff appellant. Recognize only 1 minute. I'm going to make a couple of quick points. On the discrimination claims, contrary to my sister's point, there were allegations in the complaint directly tying the decision maker, Mr. Easterly, and paragraph 46, it says that Mr. Easterly put the plaintiff on a PIP because that she pointed out problems in the security that he and another male employee did not find. So that's a very specific allegation tying his conduct and what she did to Mr. Easterly's conduct. Then if you look at for the retaliation complaint, there were, although not a direct complaint to HR about discrimination, she went to the director, someone in engineering for support about the token woman comment, and she went to HR, and if you look at paragraph 42, 47, 48, and 79, she talked to Mr. Easterly at the end. She said, I'm being set up for failure. That is a complaint about how she's being treated. Someone doesn't
counsel,
have to use,
which paragraph suggests that she went to HR rather than a colleague?
I think 47 and 48, I believe. But paragraph 79, importantly, she goes to Mr. Easterly at the end and saying, I'm being set up for failure. So those aren't the magic words of gender discrimination, but that's a, sort of a, an allegation that you're not treating me fairly. You are setting me up to fail. That's a classic sort of unlawful termination type speak. And I don't believe Verdreger says anything about you need to use sort of an actual form of the discrimination complaint to put the employer on notice before engaging in self-help discovery. But the complaint is very clear that she made her complaints of unfair treatment clear to Health Equity before these final actions, self-help discovery actions that she engaged in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.